feel a bit underwhelmed by it, to be honest. I thought it would be quite hard-hitting. I thought it would address certain key issues. Yeah, there's a lot of angry young lads on our bus this morning. Nobody knows who said it. Nobody knows whether it's a doper or a, you know, it's just completely unsubstantiated. Give us a profile, give us the evidence, give us the trends, and you can see what the trends look like.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. While I've been covering Paris-Nice for the Cycling Podcast, Cycling's Independent Reform Commission, or CIRC as everyone's been calling it, published its independent report into doping in the sport. The report was commissioned by the UCI in the wake of the United States Anti-Doping Agency's investigation into Lance Armstrong's doping. I'm sure you've read some of the commission's findings in the news and seen some of the more eye-catching headlines. The most notable one was a quote from an unnamed rider who said that 90% of the current peloton was doping. That was countered by somebody else also speaking with the guarantee of anonymity who put the figure at 20%. And this is no doubt a subject that Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and I will return to in future episodes of the podcast. Anyway, while I've been here at Paris-Nice, I sat down with Dave Brailsford, the boss of Team Sky, to ask him for his reaction to the report and also for his comments following the Mail on Sunday story about Cervais Carnarvon, one of Team Sky's sports directors, and the newspaper's allegations that Carnarvon had doped during his career. So this is our exclusive interview with Team Sky's Dave Brailsford. Dave, the Cycling Independent Reform Commission published its report. How much of the report have you read and what's been your reaction to what's in it?
Well, I haven't actually, you know, I'm here at Paris-Nice and I haven't had the document and read it line by line, but I've certainly been given the issues that are in it and given a sense of what it's all about.
Would you say then that the media coverage has perhaps shaped more of your perception of what's in the report, or have you seen enough of the report to put into context how the media has reacted to it today?
That's a good question, actually, because I think what we have is a document, and then people will see that and read that document through different lenses, depending on what part of the sport they're in. And then they'll also, you know, there's the media side of it, and you know, we can see how the media have gone about reporting the different aspects within it and what approach they've taken to it. And from what I've seen, I think some of it has gone with the big glory headline of, you know, or scandal headline, 90% of the peloton's still doping, whereas I think I've read quite a few good balance pieces which reflect what's in there in a balanced and honest and, yeah, in a good way, I think. And so, you know, as you'd expect, a bit of a broad brush, really.
That is the most eye-catching line in the entire report, that 90% of the peloton, the current peloton, is doping, in the opinion of an anonymous former rider. What was the reaction among your team when they heard this line? Because it is the first line that really jumped out from the report that really captured the imagination, I suppose, of the media and of the readers who are picking up on the story this morning.
Yeah, there's a lot of angry young lads on our bus this morning. Because of that, to be honest, I think they were, you know, they were staggered, really, that they were all looking at each other and they were annoyed, which was actually quite good to see, to be honest. But equally, I think the challenge with something like that, nobody knows who said it. Nobody knows whether it's a doper or, you know, who the rider is. You know, it's just completely unsubstantiated. So normally, if you'd have had, you know, person X says their belief is 90%, and then we can all contextualise it, we can make a judgement, and we can sort of have insight into whether we, what kind of credibility we would give to that comment coming from a particular person. You know, somebody else said it was 20%, somebody else said something else, so it's, I guess, inevitable, unfortunately, that the media look for the juiciest line and get it as the headline and go from there. So I do think, from a leadership point of view, though, the UCI is responsible, ultimately, for this sport, and with a headline like that, they should actually get out there and justify on what grounds have been said, or certainly back it up with some evidence, or not, as the case may be, because they should be the leading voice in a sport. So you can't just throw flippant comments out there, which is ultimately an opinion. Whilst everybody's opinion is valid, you've got to give it some context, and you've got to give some evidence to back it up. Why not give a historical longitudinal analysis of, you know, how many doping tests have been carried out, how many positive have been found, what's the correlation between, you know, certain different variables, you know, how many, you know, TUEs are mentioned, how many TUEs have been actually issued in the sport? Do it over 10 years, go back and say, look, here's what these are, the number of TUEs, what the distribution was like across the season. Did you see a massive kind of whole batch of TUEs being issued just before key stage races? You know, give us a profile, give us the evidence, give us the trends, and you can see what the trends look like, and you know, we can draw something from that. I think making comment without any backup is dangerous, really.
So what's your overall feeling about the report? Do you feel that it was a good thing to do? Do you think that there are some positives for cycling to take out of it? You know, where do we go from here? Because this isn't going to suddenly fade away. It's kind of the big headline today, but it's going to cast a bit of a shadow over some of the spring, I would have thought.
I think it will cast a shadow. I think you're right. I think if you'd have asked me yesterday or the day before I'd read the content of the report, is this a good thing to be doing? I think unequivocally the answer would have been yes. It was talked about, it was attempted and then failed, and eventually, you know, it was part of Brian's big pledge, wasn't it, when he got elected, that he would do this. You know, it was commissioned. I thought, when you looked at the panel, I think actually these are some, you know, pretty, you know, some hitters on there, really. We thought, actually, we're going to get something good out of this. We're really going to be able to move the sport forward. And so I'd say, without a doubt, it was a good thing to do. I don't think other sport, the fact that it's open, transparent, I also think, you know, I'd have said very much a good thing. You know, we've seen what happened in FIFA and the fact that they won't release their report, and I'm not sure that you know, gives anybody any credibility about that sport, so I'm not sure that was a good thing. So in principle it's good. Then, however, you get to the actual reading of it, and I feel a bit underwhelmed by it, to be honest. I was looking forward to it. I thought it would be quite hard-hitting. I thought it would address certain key issues that the sport needs to address, in my opinion. To keep on moving forward. It is moving forward, but keep on moving forward.
Is this more in the way that perhaps teams are run and staffed, rather than looking back at an era that where we do broadly have a fairly good understanding of what went on and how the era of real industrial usage of blood doping products played out? There's none of that is particularly revelatory. Were you looking more for a kind of a way to progress, a way to kind of regulate perhaps people who are involved working with teams?
I think that's one aspect of it. I think it is useful to go back and, you know, everybody know what happened in the past, and there's a big question about, was it, you know, was there fraud involved or not? You know, was it a conspiracy or not? And I think bottom line is, I think they're saying actually it wasn't, but it wasn't made. Their opinion is that it wasn't very well managed. We know that. That's pretty well established. The question is, what do you take from that which is tangible to make sure it never happens again? I'm not sure I'd feel like there's enough of the answers rather than just here's what happened. You know, there's the narrative of what happened, everybody, I think, pretty much knows, really. So I'd have liked, you know, and it is about governance, it is about ethics, it is about how you run an organisation to make sure you're doing the absolute best you can and using the best process to make sure that, you know, fraud or corruption doesn't occur. And, you know, how do we run a tight ship, basically? And I'd like to see a little bit more on that. The issue for me, though, is yes, that was important. However, I still think from as a, you know, as a director or a team principal, I think from our point of view, I was hoping to see a little bit more about, you know, the structure of the teams, the governance of the teams, who should be involved in a sport, who shouldn't be involved in a sport, you know, what's fit and proper person criteria, what would that look like? There's some mention, I think, about potentially ex dopers perpetuating doping practices, and that's part of an issue, which how do we address that and what do we do with that? So I think I was hoping for some names, I was hoping for some concrete, real sort of strong moves which would be game changing, really. I'm not sure I was expecting sort of suggestions which seem a little bit like tweaks, to be honest, rather than I think it was going to be a bit more hard hitting. So like I say, I feel a little bit underwhelmed by it.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
In terms of riders who have spoken to the commission, Chris Froome is one of them, one of your riders. He also waived the offer of anonymity, so his name appears in the report as having spoken to them to talk about, I'm assuming, his... Well, we don't know. The report doesn't really spell out what each individual person added to the report. One thing that's leapt out was when the riders are named at the end that they've cooperated or spoken to the people running the commission, they're all presented there, and Chris Froome, his name appears amongst a list of people who have tested positive several times, in some cases been subject of very high profile doping scandals. It doesn't strike me as particularly the greatest incentive for future cooperation when it comes to giving an accurate picture of how the sport is.
No, well, first and foremost, I think, you know, good on Chris for going down there and doing what he did, you know, and waiving his right to anonymity. I think that's a positive thing. I think it's good. On the other hand, you know, I think if you wanted to get a true reflection of the current view within the peloton, it would have been nice to have had more riders come forward and more a broader church of the current peloton really giving their honest opinion. That would have been good. And so maybe that's an opportunity that's been missed. But like you say, you know, I think you've got to be careful in like any, you know, in any kind of survey type approach, which this tends to come across as. If you're going to survey people, then you have to look at the cross-section of the people and the sample set that you take to survey. And like having a focus group, isn't it? You know, when you're doing, you know, they're looking at the elections and they'd start doing their predictions about the elections. You've got to be careful about having the right balanced group that's representative of the current cohort. And when you look down that list, is there enough people who are representative of the current cohort? You probably argue that there isn't, which is, I'd say, you know, an opportunity missed, unfortunately.
But in terms of how well publicised it was to your riders, I mean, do you know of any others who did go and talk to them from your team?
No, and it's not something that we decided to, you know, it wasn't, we didn't give a mandate, say you have to go and do it, so it's a personal thing at the end of the day. But for a lot of the guys, I'm not sure they really understood and realised what was going on. You know, I don't think they you know, it's kind of, they were aware of something and we tried to explain a little bit, but I'm not too sure they were fully engaged. And, you know, hindsight's a great thing, but I'm sure they, you know, in the future, rock up to a race, come to the team hotel, sit down and interview everybody whilst they're at a race. You know, have 20 minutes with each rider over a period of race, try and get around every team, get everybody's opinion. You know, I don't think that would have been too difficult thing to do.
You say that. I mean, what sort of questions would you be asking if you'd been running the commission? I mean, how far would you go? Would you sit down, get your eight riders together and ask them individually and anonymously, have you ever been offered doping products? Have you ever taken doping products? Have you ever had TUEs? What's your attitude to using TUEs and applying for them? I mean, these to me seem like the sort of relevant questions that would give an accurate picture of the current landscape.
Yeah, I agree, and I think I'd add, have you ever witnessed anything that you think was probably doping? Have you ever been approached about doping? You know, are you aware of anything that's going on in the sport? You know, and I think you're right. That's the sort of the line of questioning, and a bit of it is about fact finding, isn't it? You know, and I think the anonymity is important because you'd like to think people would be honest if they had the right to anonymity, and I think that's one of the principles that's applied here. But equally with anonymity, if you're going to say something in anonymity and then you publish those anonymous quotes, I'm not quite sure that's necessarily stacks up, you know.
What, because you think there might be jigsaw identification problems?
No, it's a bit like this 90% quote, isn't it? You know, we don't know who it is, don't know who said it. And if you're going to make anonymous quotes, then how do you go back and verify the nature of those quotes, you know? And I think that's where, unfortunately, it would be good to get, rather than just, you know, there's two quotes, but one person says 20%, one person says 90%. That's only two people, you know, out of the entire crop of people involved. It would have been nicer to get a broader spread of the distribution of opinion, so you could do a proper normalised distribution where you could see, actually, within one standard deviation, this is the general opinion, and then you go out to the, you know, the 95 percentile each side, and you go, actually, these are the overly positive people and these are potentially the overly negative people, but the general opinion seems to be X. And we all know about the wisdom of crowds, you know, the whole thing about the wisdom of crowds. When you ask a lot of people, you tend to get a general opinion, which isn't too far from the truth. So it's a shame that they didn't manage to achieve that.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
So in terms of how the fallout for this will affect cycling, there's been an awful lot of coverage in the media as a direct result of the report's findings. Where do you think this leaves professional cycling, particularly at a time when there are various moves to try and professionalise, really, a lot of the structures and the governance of the sport, and particularly the UCI as it tries to improve its image from an image of, at best, kind of tolerating shady practices to go on?
That's a good question, really, because I think if you're asking where does it leave the sport, I think, you know, bright people and sensible people get the report, they'll read it and they'll form their own opinion. And they'll also see, you know, so they'll read the bits, with, you know, the more negative bits, but they'll read the more positive bits, which are things like, you know, there's quite clear evidence that there's a much reduced prevalence of systematic doping within teams, for example, you know, and the EPO era does seem to be over. And so, that, you know, there are different, you know, we're saying there are maybe different doping techniques being used, but I think the prevalence of it is a lot less, and I think there are positives in there. And we haven't got to an end point. What we're doing is that, you know, the sport was in a mess and it's moving forward, and it's moving forward in steps. And I think you can recognise that actually, the, you know, some of the positive things as well as some of the more challenging, you know, things that are in the port. So if you're somebody who wants to really understand what that report's like, you'd read it yourself. You wouldn't think about the newspapers, and you'd think about forming your own opinion. However, if you're going to read the newspaper's opinion, a lot of them, from what I can see, you know, have gone for the headline, which will bias people's opinions and maybe not give a true reflection of the report. Who knows? And I think that's a bit of a challenge. So you've got PR on one side and facts, and making up your own decision on the other, I guess.
In terms of the challenge ahead for the UCI and for the anti-doping authorities, it does seem from the report that sort of micro-dosing is the area that needs to be looked at next. It's the clamping down on the opportunity for systematic doping within teams, heavy usage of doping, all of the things that we've read about in Tyler Hamilton's books and Lance Armstrong's confession and all of that. It's scaled down to restrict opportunity and restrict the benefits, but still the temptation may be there for microdosing or using, you know, less heavyweight substances perhaps. So do you think that's where the UCI needs to invest? I mean, how, if you were head of the UCI's anti-doping policy, what would you be doing, knowing that you've got 20 plus teams to police?
I think if I was the head of the UCI looking after the doping side of things, I would start with a zero tolerance to all the little things, rather than going for the big hit to knock out the big things. I think you'd do both, obviously, but I think if you did get on top of, right, really get on top of all of the sort of the creep around the edges that seems to potentially be possible, you know, is there a misuse of TUEs, you know, tramadol, etc., etc., etc. If you really clamped down and made it impossible to have all those little things, you kind of create an environment then, which is, I think, you're working from, you know, all those little things were clumped together, you know, it's a bit like a... And they give you, put you in a better place. But also, you've got to go for the big thing. So I'd have, personally, I would go more along the route of getting, for the World Tour teams, 22 really qualified guys who are like investigators, if you like, and I'd make them live and be amongst every team. I'd rotate them so they couldn't get bought off and there was no bias. And I'd make them so they'd be with us at this race. They'd be in our team meetings. They'd be in our medical notes. They could have a list of everything the rider was taking, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and really have somebody on the case. They can talk to our doctors. They can see every single thing, that every prescription they write out, they could have. They can liaise with one another. They could look at all, you know, they could just look at everything going on, you know.
So stay in the hotel, travel in the bus, as far as that?
Yeah, go in everybody's suitcase. If somebody's microdosing during the race, or microdosing, presumably they've got to take something with them. Where is it? If you have somebody in the team and it was just, all they did was hunt around all the time, went into the riders, okay, might piss them off a bit, don't get me wrong. But, you know, why not go into all of our suitcases, have a look at everything. Everything's open door policy. For every team, this is, you know, that's what I'd start doing, personally. Some people might be a bit frustrated by that and they might get, you know, they'll claim the human rights and everything, but I've always thought, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to hide, why would it bother you, you know?
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
The other Sky-related news that broke today was that Chris Froome had pulled out of Tirreno Adriatico, the Italian stage race, with a chest infection. This means he will now not go up against Vincenzo Nibali, Alberto Contador and Nairo Quintana as eagerly anticipated. But there's a wider context to this story. Last year, Chris Froome applied for and was granted by the authorities a TUE, or therapeutic use exemption, which was given to allow him to treat a bronchial condition that he was suffering at the Tour of Romandy. That was a race he went on to win. TUEs are supposed to be confidential, but the news was leaked to a newspaper and there was some controversy about the matter. So I asked Dave Brailsford about Froome's latest illness. Can you explain a little bit about what's the situation is with Chris at the moment?
Yeah, he's got a chest infection, unfortunately, and what we don't want to do is if he goes and makes some, you know, strong violent efforts in a race, chances are it could make it worse. So I think from a precautionary point of view, we just thought, you know, it starts with a team time trial, it's quite a violent effort obviously, and so we just want to be careful and make sure that it doesn't get any worse, get him right, you know, which is a hit in the short term, but hopefully longer term, he gets his health back up to 100%. You know, he's in great shape. He was doing some of his, you know, he, he's better this year, I think, than he's ever been at this time of year, I'd say. But so he's, you know, I don't think he'll lose too much, so I don't think there's too much of a risk on that side. But on the other hand, better be safe and a little bit conservative.
Now, last year, obviously, Chris applied for and was granted a TUE for the Tour of Romandy, which he subsequently won, and obviously that story then came out and caused a fair bit of controversy, which you had to deal with. Is Chris's condition too serious to be treated with a regular medicine or a prescribed medicine, or did you consider a TUE? Did you consider it, and reflecting on last year's controversy, decide not to pursue that course of events?
Well, you know, I think the whole TUE thing's worth clarifying a little bit. We can't decide whether he has a TUE or not. He has to go and get it, you know, tested, and there has to be sort of medical parameters which he has to have met before he can be given a TUE or not. So it's not something that we pull out of our back pocket and go, oh, by the way, we'll use this joker. You know, it's just not how it works. And I think it's also worth clarifying that, you know, these guys, all the riders, professional cyclists, they push themselves to a limit. And they're riding it in, you know, it's pretty extreme what they're doing to themselves. But when they get sick, to a certain extent, if they get, you know, very sick, there are certain medications that they need to use to get them better. And I've got no problem with, you know, the right medication being used for the right illness for the right reason. However, I do think that it's, you know, it is worth taking into consideration the fact that there is a growing concern, I think, about the use of TUEs. And I think wherever possible, not issuing TUEs during a race makes sense. You know, I think we are trying to work in an environment where more and more we need to try and get the confidence of people. So if that can be avoided, then I think it's a good thing. So, I haven't spoken to the doctor today who's looking at Chris, so I couldn't give you an exact update. But, you know, he won't be racing with a TUE in Torino, that's for sure.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
The Mail on Sunday pieced together documents from a court case that centred on the TVM team that was raided by police during the 1998 Tour de France and eventually withdrew from that race. Stephen de Jong and Servais Canavan were both members of that TVM team, and years later they became sports directors at Team Sky. After the reasoned decision in 2012 that brought about the downfall of Lance Armstrong, Team Sky sat down with all of their riders and management to reiterate their zero-tolerance policy. After that, there were a number of departures from the team, including Sean Yates, Stephen de Jong and Bobby Julich, all of whom have since returned to the sport and are currently working with Tinkoff Saxo. A correction here, during the interview I said that Julich was with BMC. He was last season, but he's since joined Tinkoff Saxo. This goes back to late 2009 in a way, and an interview I did with Dave Brailsford. During that interview, I questioned what he meant by zero tolerance. At the time, he said Team Sky would not hire anyone with an association with doping, and I'd wanted to know what he meant by that. If I'm blunt, the Mail on Sunday story, thoroughly researched though it was, did not contain much that couldn't have been ascertained by visiting the offices of Cycling Weekly and reading the magazine's coverage of the arrest and court case as it played out between 1998 and 2001. This is not a defence of Sky, but it is worth bearing in mind that there's no rule that says ex-dopers cannot work for pro teams. The zero-tolerance approach is not a UCI rule, but a Sky policy. Anyway, I asked Brailsford about the Canavan case and where it stands now. What was your reaction to that story, and what's the latest situation with Servais Canavan?
Well, I think the fundamental sort of starting point for that story is, well, two things really. One is, you know, this is something that happened 17, 18 years ago, whatever. However, it's still, I can still see why it's relevant. And the other, of course, is the, you know, our zero tolerance policy. And I think it was the challenge that is presented to our policy was the issue, more than necessarily an attack on Servais directly, as far as I could see anyway. So I think it's worth reiterating, really, and clarifying that when we started, you know, we sat down at the start of Team Sky with a blank sheet of paper, and you think, right, OK, how are we going to do this? What approach should we take to this? And at the time, we thought, you know what, shall we take people in the team who've been, you know, prosecuted for doping or been sanctioned for doping? And we thought, actually, no, we won't do that. In 2012, we sort of expanded out to active involvement in doping. And basically, the premise being, you know, we don't have to. We're a clean team. We can make our own recruitment policy. A lot of the guys that we were interested in creating this team for were kind of, you know, those young guys coming up through the British Cycling Academy who'd, you know, come up through a system, and we thought, you know, it'd be good to create a coaching-led environment where, you know, that there was nobody there who'd basically had been convicted of doping in the past, and we thought that was a good environment to create. And it was difficult at the time because there was obviously Dave Miller who'd had this conviction, and it'd have been great in many respects. You think, to start a British team and all the rest of it. So it was a tough decision that at the time to say no, but that's the decision we decided we'd take. So from then on, we also then said, actually, from a recruitment point of view, we'll try and avoid where we can. We won't appoint anybody who's had a previous conviction for doping, but obviously it's got to be substantiated. But at the same time, we employ people, and we've employed a bunch of people, and we've got to work with them and trust them as well. So, it's pretty clear to everybody when they joined Team Sky what our stance was, and so everybody knows when they join this team what they're getting themselves in for, and they sign up for it. Then 2012 came along, and the whole...
So this is the recent decision, the USADA investigation into Lance Armstrong, and there were various people named, and the fallout. Just one example that's on the record, Bobby Julich left the team and is now working with BMC, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And so 2012 came along, and that all happened, and it was like, actually, hold on a second, we might have to have another look at our roster here. So we sat down and we said to everybody, look, we had an interview with everybody, including with myself and Steve Peters, and we just basically said, look, guys, listen, this is our policy. We stand by it. And look, if you've done something, if you have had something in the past, we're not judging you. You did what you did. It's not, I'm not here to judge you necessarily, but what I am here to do is say we have a policy. And, if you want to come forward and hold your hand up and say, yep, okay, I can't be here because of this policy, then we'll try and support you. We'll try and part in good company, try and support you into other employment, etc. And if you have, if you come and look us in the eye and say, no, I've absolutely never, ever, ever done anything, and you have your interview with Steve Peters and you that's what your stance is, then we're going to take you at face value. And obviously, there's a working sort of relationship there, and there's a trust that needs to be maintained. But let's make it clear that should something come out in the future or something substantiate this in the future, then that's it, you're out. And at that point, Stephen and Bobby both came forward. We, parted company with them, and everybody else in the team signed their document and stayed. And and then just recently the journalist from the Mail on Sunday went to Rems, that's right, yeah.
Tricky one for us Anglos to say that.
You just made a better job than I did. And he went and got all of the court papers from that period and all the, 300 pages of documentation, etc., and got it all out, read it all, and got some various blood analysis and blood values, etc., and we had a look at that. So then we were presented with that, and then I just have to stop and think, okay, well, what do I do with this situation now? So what I thought was that the right way to deal with it was that actually if there's any situation that arises at the minute from an anti-doping point of view, we have a governance process which isn't, I'm not involved in it, so I hand the information to. Put it in a process, it's then handed out to different experts for interpretation. Those experts give an independent analysis. They come back and say, this is our opinion, and then I can take action off the back of that.
So they're not employed by Team Sky, other than they're independent people, are they?
Yeah, they're not employed. They're not employees of Team Sky. Although, I'd have to double check, might pay for an hourly rate for their service. But they're not, they're not an employee as such. There's no formal kind of...
They're not paid to come up with a certain answer.
Defeats the point. It doesn't protect us, and the whole point of this is that it protects us. I want to be protected.
So you can't be done for wrongful dismissal or anything like that?
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of, these people have some of them in employment relationships, some are contractual relationships, so we've got to be careful how we deal with this from a staffing point of view. But also, I want to protect this team as well, and the way to protect somebody, yourself and a team, is to have independent experts who look at data. They don't know it is, and they go, right, okay, in my opinion there is a problem here, or in my opinion there is not a problem here. On the basis of that, we can then act, and then can put it to the right, into the right board, into the right processes, and then action can be taken.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So we got the information that had been given, sent it to the guys. They came back and said, actually, on the basis of what we have here, you cannot say beyond reasonable doubt that there's absolute evidence to say that he took EPO. And so, unfortunately, there was nothing concrete. Whilst I understand the criminal case at the time, there's nothing concrete in there and says, absolutely. So us, there's a, you know, this is undeniable, you know. You know, so what we did, we got this information, sat down with Servas again, and he maintains that his position, that as he did before, that he's absolutely never done anything. And whilst he maintains that position, and without anything absolutely concrete to the contrary, then we have to take him as his word. And that's the situation. And I understand the challenge of that in terms of there are certain, you know, there's no doubt about it, let's be honest about it, there are certain people who've ridden at a certain period within this sport, and you know, unfortunately they're all going to have a cloud over them, but that doesn't mean to say that necessarily they all did it, you know. And I think it's a tricky one, because I don't believe in lynch mobs. You know, lynch mobs went out a long time ago within society, and along came the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And I am actually a fan of that. You know, we've got to be careful here that you haven't got a false positive. So we can take the lynch mob mentality, or we can take that, you know, let's beyond reasonable doubt that somebody's guilty or not, and then you can take action. And that's where we're at, really.
Thinking back to sort of 2009-10, we had an interview which ended up being quite tense, in which I was asking you for your definition of what an association with doping was. Do you, when you reflect on the recruitment policy, and looking particularly at hiring Stephen de Jong and Cervais Carnarvon, who were in that 1998 TVM team, who, if you remember that tour, you know, they were arrested, they were held in a cell overnight, some of them at the Tour de France.
I remember the conversation very well, actually. Yeah, I do. But let's be fair to, let's make sure that we report and talk about the situation as it happened. What happened was, they were racing in Murcia, that team, and they finished the race. Somebody's driving a truck. One of the mechanics is driving a truck back, and at the border, the truck got stopped. And in the back of the truck, there was some EPO. Servas wasn't part of that race. At a later date, the authorities, the criminal authorities, decided that they wanted to try and prosecute or go after the doctor. I think the team manager,
Mikhailov, and Case Prime was the team manager.
Yeah, and actually get them for supply of doping products, misuse of doping products. So during the tour, the reason that all the guys got stopped and they all got taken to hospital, urine test, blood test, and hair test, was to try and establish a case, so they became witnesses in the case against the doctor, and I think they went back to later date, like sort of December time, to give witness statements, etc., etc. So that was the process. The riders themselves weren't under, you know, it wasn't them who were being prosecuted as such. However, I still understand that, you know, it raises questions. There's no doubt about it, and I take that fully on board. But I think, to be fair, equally, I think there's this, you know, innocent until proven guilty is something I think, you know, we've got to be careful with, and that's the situation we're in.
Because I think from what you were saying earlier in the conversation about previous generations of dopers becoming team managers and implementing some kind of fit and proper person test to make sure that, you know, the secrets of a past generation aren't passed down to young riders coming into the sport, because, you know, most teenagers don't come into cycling dreaming of injecting substances and hooking themselves up to drips and getting involved in, you know, a sport which requires that of them. The difficulty in this case is, if you set out, you've got the zero tolerance policy, and then it comes to light that people have been involved in that or haven't, and some have been and have left but are now free to go and work for other teams. Do you not feel that the policy is unworkable and not worth persisting with?
Wouldn't it be easier, but you would
lay yourself, you wouldn't lay yourself open to the accusations of hypocrisy.
I don't mind. Listen, life isn't easy, you know, and getting to certain places in life isn't easy, and sometimes it's a journey, and sometimes you get things right, and sometimes you get things wrong. And because it's a challenge, and these situations have presented a challenge, to manage doesn't mean to say it's wrong. And if that means we're going to get criticised, even though we're still doing the right thing, you know, in general, I still believe that we're doing the right thing 100%, and I still think it's good to have a zero-tolerance policy, and I still think it's good to try and have people who haven't had a doping past, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if it turns out that we have got people, we'll get rid of them. Unfortunately, that might mean a few bumps, and it's not easy. Turning around and going, I tell you what, let's just be like everybody else. Let's not bother with this one. Let's just hire anybody. You know, doesn't matter what the background is, we'll just take them into the team. I don't want to do that. And I don't want to have, riders who've served doping bans in this team. I don't want them. And that's the way it is. So if that means that, you know, people can hit me with a stick because of that, and because they're not sure about, you know, it doesn't quite sound, you know, it's difficult to see how some of this fits together. I'll take it on a chin. I'll try and explain myself. But I still think, personally, this is what we're trying to aspire towards. And it is. We're aspiring towards doing something and trying our best to do something. We're a clean team. We're not cheating. We're doing it the right way. We're a coaching-led team. We're using science. We're using technology. There's no doubt about it. And we're using that to the utmost to try and, you know, inform how we can get better at human performance. But we're a clean team. And I think that we're the type of team that this sport needs, because we are forward-thinking. I will put my neck on the line. I will take the knocks. I don't mind being criticised if I think it's going to get us to a better place. And that's the way I see it. And that's what I'm going to continue to do, you know. And sometimes, you know, I think from a leadership point of view, the UCI should be a little bit more, you know, stick your neck out, you know, a little bit more. Be a bit more bold with some of the things they're doing, you know. And if you're criticised for it, so, you know, that's part and parcel of getting to somewhere new. You can't change something. If you want to change something in life, normally you're going to get some resistance and you're going to get some knocks along the way. For sure you are. But, you know, if there's obstacles, find a way around it. You know, I think we could do a lot more. I really do. But UCI lead the sport. I lead this team. So I'll lead this team the way I can, and I'll do whatever I can to try and help the sport and show that and demonstrate what can be done. And the UCI should be doing the same.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
So does it frustrate you when the assumption is that you must have found something, some kind of technique, some kind of substance that is helping cut corners there?
Well, I think you always, you know, the challenge of this environment is if you do something, people always assume the worst first and see it through that lens. And you could argue, you know, given the past of the sport, fair enough, I think people are right to, you know, to ask questions. On the other hand, you know, most people know that if you stop eating enough and you manage that correctly and you manage it carefully, then you can get to, you know, a very, very lean state for a short period of time and try and maintain as much muscle mass as possible. And, you know, that's what we try and do. If we're asked questions about that, then we should try and answer what we do and how we do it. But I don't think we should shy away from it, you know, and I think that's the whole point, is that there's no taboo subject here. There's nothing I won't talk about. There's nothing I won't answer. You know, I'll have a debate about anything. We'll talk about everything. And there is no taboo subject. So, you know, I think bring it on, and hopefully I can show people what we do and how we do it without educating the rest of the peloton to you know, it's always a bit of a dilemma. Like, you think, well, actually, we'll tell everybody what we're doing and how we're doing it, and then everybody else copies us and beats us. So, but there we go.
And lastly, you know, 5 years into this journey, are you frustrated that so many of the questions keep coming back to the problem of doping, and that cycling doesn't appear to be able to shake itself free of that?
It's not easy, you know, because the better you do your job, the more questions get asked in this game, which is a bit of a funny one, really. And it's, you know, it's not a topic that, you know, I've never had a conversation with any rider of any age at any point about, you know, doping or wanting to dope, etc., etc. Never, and I never will. So it is difficult to get pulled into a world that I was never involved in, don't want to be involved in, never will be involved in. However, you recognise your role, you know, in the position that I've got. I recognise my role in trying to move things forward. And I honestly, when I started the team, when we came into this, I didn't think I really realised the kind of leadership role that would be, you know, come to the fore, if you like, in this particular area. But I take it, you know, take it on board, and I think it's something I've got to do, and it's a responsibility, and anything that we can do to support the guys. What you've got to remember at the heart of all of this is, you know, you've got lads like, you know, we're just watching Paris-Nice here now, just seeing Luke Rowe on the telly. Luke Rowe, your Ben Swifts, your Geraint Thomas, you know, the guys who are coming up, particularly those young guys, it's hard for them. They've done nothing wrong. They're not cheating. You know, they're 100% they're not cheating. And somebody needs to look after them. And somebody needs to fight for their future. And somebody needs to fight for the fact that everybody should understand they're not cheating. And if that's got to be me, because they're all I'm in, then I'm happy to do that, because they deserve to be looked after.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We talk in a bit more detail about Sky's recruitment policy and anti-doping policy in the Friends of the Podcast special episode, which looks at the first 5 years of Team Sky and is available to everyone who's signed up to the Friends of the Podcast scheme. And you can do that by visiting www.thecyclingpodcast.com. It will cost you £5, but for that you'll get 11 special episodes, which we'll be releasing on roughly a monthly basis over the course of the year. The second of those special episodes will be released in a couple of weeks' time. We're working on that at the moment. All that leaves me to say is a big thank you to our two sponsors, Van Dessel and British Eurosport. So thank you very much for listening.
To the Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.